Well, good morning, friends. It's good to be back together. I'll tell you, I've been in a pastoral role since I was 21. So it was really weird not to be part of church community on Sunday, last Sunday. So, but we were safe, we were sound. We got to experience some neighborly love by shoveling together and clearing some snow of our loved ones or watching somebody clear the snow of our fronts. And that was an important thing. And today we watch it all melt, which is great part of living in Saskatchewan, the variety of seasons you get in 1 week. Was it like a 30-degree swing everywhere? Yeah. Anyways, welcome here. Today we continue our Lenten journey through the... We continue our Lenten journey in trusting God through the wilderness, learning to understand God's movements and love for us in seasons of scarcity, in seasons when things just don't quite seem to make sense. And today, in our progression of going through 1 Corinthians, we're going to be looking at the issue or the conversation of intimacy. So what we have learned so far is that God actually invites us and calls us into the wilderness. It is not something we just accidentally find ourselves in. There's a call that God makes in our life into the wilderness. And he does this because the most significant and spiritual growth and development in our spiritual journey actually happens in the wilderness, in the scarcity, right? And we kind of know that. We don't want to go into the wilderness. We don't want to go into the scarcity, but we know that some of the best growth happens there. Think about it. One of the famous phrases that has been used a lot for a variety of things, a quote that says, "There's no atheist in the foxhole." This is a phrase attributed to correspondent Ernie Pyle, who references, you know, this conversation of like being in the middle of war, being in the middle of something horrible and terrible, and when you're in the midst of that, there are no atheists, was his claim. And really what he's touching on, what he's talking about, is that we do seem to seek someone or something outside of ourselves when we find ourselves in a difficult situation, don't we? When a relational, financial, or health difficulty arises, we look for someone outside of ourselves to make sense of this. Like, it just shouldn't be happening. And with something in us, like, we're just wired and forged this way to make sense of life when things go badly. And when we do, what happens is that the wilderness begins to expose and reveal those desires and expectations and hopes that we hold in our hearts. And so it's in the wilderness that the systems and structures that speak into our desires and hopes begin to be revealed. And these systems and structures are simply ways we understand the world to work, for good and for bad. So when the structures themselves, when they fail us, because life doesn't go the way we thought it would, we find ourselves in this wilderness, and it's exactly there in that moment of scarcity, in that moment of wilderness where God invites us to lean on him and to trust him. Our own way of surviving in the old structures, living in them and making it on our own strength, ingenuity, or even our understanding is put to the test, and all of a sudden things just don't make sense. And let's just, if we're just honest, when we have a system of way we do life and understand life, when that stops working, it's pretty destabilizing. I mean, it's easier to observe somebody else go through it and go, "Oh, that's all right, things will work out." But when it happens to us, the thing that we never thought would happen to us, it becomes very destabilizing. And what we have seen is just like in us, Israel too, when it's rescued out of slavery, the structures and systems Israel knew was structures of their owners, the slave drivers, how they treated them. And if they just put in the work, they got a result. And they understood that structure. And now God is leading them out of Egypt, out of that structure, and things begin to fall apart, and things don't work as they thought they would. They thought they'd be more free, but they thought they'd be more free in the way that Egypt exercised power and freedom. So wilderness becomes destabilizing for them as well. And this is where we find ourselves in the conversation. So Israel, we have learned through our conversation, is called into wilderness for their spiritual journey. We have looked at that Jesus, once he's baptized, is called into the wilderness himself. And we find ourselves in the Lenten wilderness today, especially if we take our spiritual journey seriously. We begin to look and notice what God is doing in this time. So to help us navigate this whole conversation, as we have said, we have looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 to 13, in which Apostle Paul writes to the church of Corinth, and by extension to us. And we have looked at all these 13 verses, but we really focus on verse 6 on one of the first Sundays, and we learned that the wilderness exposes our desires, and that all our desires, our good, bad, and everything in between desires, are actually rooted in our desire for God. And then in verse 7, we saw what happens with those desires is that when God doesn't come through in the way we thought he would, we become very impatient with God. We become frustrated with God. And then we begin to fashion gods who would meet that thing that we thought would be met by God himself. So we create idols to do for us what God is seemingly not doing. So on our strength, we begin to create these things instead of resting in God. We strive, we work, we try to solve the issues, we fix and we work, and we have become really good at it. We do it through political, through financial, through relational means. We create idols that we can understand and manage to make sense of life where God is seemingly not coming through. So today in this movement from verse 6 to 7, we are finding ourselves in verse 8, and we're going to look at a challenging verse. But a verse that I want to start with that deals with intimacy. Now, the word intimacy itself elicits various emotions and thoughts. We all have ideas what intimacy is and what it's not. Perhaps for some of us, intimacy means fear and confusion. For others, perhaps it means like longing and anticipation. There's something in us that kind of understands intimacy, but also has some confusion around it. And we all seem to want intimacy. We describe it in a variety of ways, whether we talk about being extroverted or introverted. Intimacy is when I have space for myself. Intimacy is when I'm with other people. We have a variety of ways of talking about it, but we all seem to look for it. And there's an interesting thing, and there's lots of science around this, that when a baby is born, when I've had the honor of seeing both my boys be born and hold them like basically, you know, right in the first moments of their birth, I cut the umbilical cord. It's really like mushy. You think it's, anyways, it's a whole thing. But right in that moment, babies have this, and there's lots of science behind this, have this instinctual drive to look for faces. Did you know that? That from moment one, babies have this instinct to search, to look everywhere, to be almost panicking, looking for a face to mirror back to them. They're looking for a face, for a connection, to feel intimacy of protection, care, love, radiating to them from a face of intimacy, loving them back. From moment one of birth, we, all of us in this room, each and every one of us as a baby, looked for a face to love us back, to be known, to be seen, to be loved. We are all forged and created in this way. We need intimacy, in fact, to survive. The baby will cry out and cry till there's a connection and intimacy is made, looking and crying. In fact, the survival, the need for survival behind intimacy is so huge that neglecting a baby, neglecting a child, neglecting a youth, a young adult, neglecting an adult, neglecting a senior has detrimental repercussions. We are forged and created and designed to look and see a face looking lovingly back at us. Isn't that amazing? And so today we're going to unpack a difficult verse in 1 Corinthians that speaks to this desire for relationships and intimacy. Now, we have said in these 13 verses of 1 Corinthians that Paul is using a template to warn us not to do what Israel did. And we have seen that from verses 6 to 7 that these warnings are tied to desire and impatience, and it was cravings and idol worship. And we've seen how the foundational building blocks in us are being hijacked and used improperly. So we're going to read verses 6 to 8 and land on verse 8 today. So we read out of this letter. Again, this is Paul warning. So he says, these things that happened to Israel as a warning to us, so that we would not crave evil things as they did, so we would not over desire things we're not meant to desire, or worship idols as some of them did, that is, get impatient with God and create gods in our own image. As the scriptures say, the people celebrated with feasting and drinking, and they indulge in pagan revelry, and we must not engage in sexual immorality, as some of them did. So our focus today is this movement that we talked about, over-desire, impatience, that leads to conversation of intimacy. And we must not engage in sexual immorality as some of them did. There's a lot going on in this verse, and there's a lot of things that I'm certain that are coming to your mind as you read this passage. Maybe you've read it many, many, many times, a million times. Maybe it's the first time you've seen this verse, and I'm certain there are things that are bubbling inside of you. And I just want to say and encourage you, notice what's rising up as you read this verse. Notice the feelings, like if it's pride, if it's like, finally, we're talking about this. Finally, the church is addressing sexual immorality. Notice that. Hold that for this conversation and bring it to God as we pray through the week and have conversation in your home church. Maybe it's feelings of shame that rise up as you read this verse. Oh, my past always seems to catch up to me, and now we're going to be talking about it in church. Maybe it's a feeling of confusion. This again? Why is the church so focused and concerned about sex? Notice the things that are coming up in you and just hold them. I'm just going to invite you to hold them and notice them and leave them with God for now. Where do you naturally go in this conversation is really important to note. But to help us fully understand what Apostle Paul is actually talking about here, it is always helpful to understand the context this is written, where it's coming from, to understand where it's going in the story of God, and what is exactly Apostle Paul is addressing. So we could simply take this verse at face value, and there's some merit to that. There's benefit to saying, yeah, there's something, sexual immorality seems like something bad that we shouldn't engage in. That's fair. But why did Paul choose to write this difficult verse? Why did he choose to name this in light of Israel in the wilderness to a church in Greece? What is the warning that's happening here? So all of us are really removed from the historical Corinth of the first century. We're removed and don't know the religious climate of Corinth. So it's helpful for us to know and note that in the first century, Corinthian communities, they included worship of idols mixed in worship with sexual expressions. This is something that happened. There was literally in Corinth temples of worship which included sex with prostitutes. This was a reality and a way to worship idols and express intimacy and to fulfill relationships with gods. And this was an accepted and encouraged practice by the priests of those temples and accepted by the local population. And it was seen as a way to worship and to make things right and to bring certain kind of relationships to a conclusion or certain needs to a conclusion. And so for the early Christians who had been learning a new way of life in Jesus, this religious practice and this cultural reality of worship and sex in the temples was a real temptation. There was worlds colliding. And so Apostle Paul is warning the church in Corinth by reminding them that this is not the way of Jesus. And that this current practice of worship and sex is the same situation actually that Israel found itself in the wilderness. So the reason he's speaking to this is he's seeing the same template happen with Israel as they find themselves in the wilderness. And we read in the book of Numbers, chapter 25, verses 1 to 3, which Paul is referencing, and we read this, something very similar occurred. While the Israelites were camped at Acacia Grove, some of the men defiled themselves by having sexual relations with local Moabite women. These women invited them to attend sacrifices to their gods. So the Israelites feasted with them and worshiped the gods of Moab. In this way, Israel joined the worship of Baal of Peor, causing the Lord's anger to blaze against his people. Now, we tend to get caught up in sensationalized parts of this story, and both of the stories, the Corinth and the Israelite story, and that's fair. There are many things that are happening here that draw our attention and pull us in different directions. We live in a different world today. But in the Corinthian letter and Paul's warning, the root issue for Apostle Paul here is that he's warning the Corinth about from Israel's history is the mixture of sexuality and worship. The mixture of worshiping idols through sex in the temple with prostitutes. This is a pretty PG conversation here, hey? Again, you may wonder about the relevance to us. Certainly in today's world, we don't seem to be tempted in the same ways. We don't seem to go to, that I know, to temples to have sex with prostitutes in a way of worship. However, the connection with worship might actually be pointing to something more significant about our sexuality than we realize at first blush. I want to suggest that there's actually a deep intimacy and longing connected in us to our Creator. Therefore, our sexuality is connected to worship. There's lots going on here. And if we look at the broader context of 1 Corinthians, we see the discussion of sexuality is laced throughout the pages of the letter. The immorality of the ancient people of Israel and their stories also laced with sexual relations that are deeply connected and attached to worshiping false gods and idols. So what's happening here? I want us to note and to see that the reality that is being exposed in the wilderness is that we as people are deeply designed for relationship and intimacy. As we look for God, we get impatient with God and we seek intimacy that we feel he's not providing for us. And as babies from day one, hour one, minute one, we look for connection, we search deeply for a loving face to look back at us. And in the wilderness, in moments of isolation and desolation, we do not see someone looking back. So when we read these stories from our vantage point, we again are tempted to shake our heads at the Corinthians or the Israelites and say, well, I mean, Israel, you were led by God through all those things. How could you possibly begin to worship other gods? Corinthians, like, why would you be doing this? But pause for a moment and consider and think about how common the practice was back then to do this kind of worship when God wasn't showing up in ways they thought he would. If we look back at history, we would see that this was a practice that was pretty common in the world. And in fact, the reason this practice is more rare today is because the way Jesus has transformed the world and gave dignity to women, to children, to men, to realign their worship and intimacy to Jesus, which looks radically different than the worship in Corinth temples. The way of Jesus gave worth and dignity to people that in history didn't exist. See, the wilderness, as we pulled us away from God, made us impatient with God so much so that we began to constantly fix our need for intimacy in a variety of ways that just wasn't helpful. So what's being exposed in this wilderness journey and Paul is warning us about is the longing for intimacy that is being trying to be solved in a variety of ways away from God. But the story of God reveals to us that the longing actually comes from God. That this longing for intimacy from day one is forged in us is actually from God for God. And is shared with others only in a way that gives dignity and compassion that God gives. God desires that we actually connect with him. He's a personal God. He desires to have a relationship with us. But in the wilderness, as we look for comfort, for love and connection, because of the disconnection and isolation, we feel the temptation to look towards sex to dispel the disconnectedness. Know the progression of thought we have looked through in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 6 to 8. Apostle Paul's warning: do not crave evil. Do not worship idols. Do not participate in sexual immorality. Oops. There we go. Do you see what the Apostle Paul, what he's unpacking for us here? He's showing us the natural desires that he's given us, things that he's forged with us, and in this warning, he's showing us in ways we have hijacked those natural things to be craving evil, idolatry, and sexual immorality. We have hijacked things like desire. Sorry, friends. A little bit of a difficulty here with keynote. Okay. We have hijacked good things like desire. Look, Paul is saying, as we have explored 2 weeks ago, desire is actually good. It's from God. And even when we desire wrong things or inappropriate things, we need to notice that and pray through that because there's a desire behind the desire that's actually leading to God. And that sounds confusing, but J.K. Chesterton once wrote this: every man who knocks on the door of a brothel is looking for God. This describes the desire behind the desire so well. I'll just hold it here for a second. Every man who knocks at the door of a brothel is looking for God. The worship in the temples. Underneath every desire is our desire for God. The goal is not to get rid of our desires, but to redirect them. And then Paul explains that our desires in the wrong direction will lead us to impatience with God. Instead of the good desire of patience and trust, we become so quickly impatient in the wilderness and try to solve and fix and to do only what God can do. We begin to fashion gods in and for our desires. We will try to fix, we will try to, and we get pretty good at it if I'm honest, right? We're pretty good at making excellent idols, actually. We're pretty good at making idols out of things we own, things we long for, jobs we work, relationships we have. But the root problem behind those symptoms is actually impatience, rooted in our over-desire, which exists because of our unwillingness to trust God. And then Paul leads us to the natural next step, that this over-desire, fueled by impatience, leads us to solve, to fix, and to find intimacy on our own terms. I will fix the problem. I will find a way to have intimacy because God is not coming through in the way I thought he would. It needs to be said that Paul, Apostle Paul here, is not bashing intimacy or sex. He's not against relationships or sex. He's in fact reminding us that we're made for it. We're made for the relationships. The problem Apostle Paul is addressing is our losing sight of God in the isolation of the wilderness, when intimacy is not showing up in the way we thought it would. The sexualized worship of these biblical passages present a pattern which is all too common, isn't it? Use sex to attempt to find intimacy and ultimately become connected to something or someone other than God. Use sex as a tool. Do you see how this hijacks our intended purpose of intimacy? In which a divine pattern that God created in all of us, intimacy, love, and connection with God, which becomes the context for all other, our other relational connections with others. But when we hijack it, we actually find ourselves disconnected from God and others in a powerful way. We actually bring more havoc and problems into our own life, and can I suggest into the world, by solving problems only God can solve. By not trusting him in the wilderness, even with our intimacy and our loneliness. When our experience of love is rightly ordered, sexuality, and really any relational connection is a beautiful gift that points back to God, to the love of God, and is the expression of God's love. So we need to be reminded that relationships, intimacy, and worship are actually deeply rooted in God. They're all rooted in God. The worship of idols with sex, with prostitutes in a temple, was a hijacking of the intimacy and worship with God that we're meant to have. It's an over-desire taken in the wrong direction. And it shouldn't be a surprise that our intimacy leads us to worship. We're designed for it. And there's a paradox in all of this. We're good at solving problems, even intimacy. But our solutions are more often than not outside of God, which creates more disconnection. And even though the solutions like sex feel like a connection, feel like intimacy, it isn't. So we keep chasing more connections, chasing them at our own expense, instead of trusting God in the isolation of the wilderness. So here's what it all reveals. It reveals how lonely and isolating we can feel at times. In times of scarcity, in times when things go wrong, in times when relationships break up, in times when families have fractures. The world is not as we thought it would be. And we could begin to numb that pain and try to solve it on our own, and we try to use sex in particular to solve the problem of isolation, even in marriage. And when sex doesn't become the cure of isolation we hoped it would, we play the blame game and move on. And we search and move on, worshiping something that doesn't ever solve the problem. It all reveals our impatience with God. Apostle Paul reminds us that our worship then is actually deeply tied to our actions and sexuality. We are holistic beings who are not to suppress who we are, but to trust our whole being to God. So the question for us, are we willing to trust God in the wilderness with our intimacy? Or will we solve it on our own? Intimacy in itself, sex in itself, isn't the problem. The problem is how we use it. And the wilderness is an invitation to strip all those learned responses to life, all those structures of Egypt, all those things of power, sex, and control, so that we might experience a reshaping, that we might experience a renewing of our capacity to love and to be loved. So our teaching today is all about the movement in the wilderness from isolation to intimacy. It is an invitation to search our hearts, to examine our feelings of disconnection and isolation, and to consider how intimacy finds its fullest realization in God alone. The wilderness isolation is an invitation to remember that you are actually not alone. So what do we do with this? There's a lot of paradoxes here. There's a lot of feelings that be rising up. Finally, we're talking about sexual immorality, or man, there's so much shame I feel where places I might have failed intimately. Or maybe there's just uncertainty, like, okay, what do I do with this? I have intimacy. God has made it into me, and it's for him, but I still feel so lonely. What do I do with all of this? Can I give you a practical step? Pray. Now, I know this is a Sunday school answer, and you're like, oh, okay, well, that solved it. I know, it's okay to play. I know, those feelings rise up, it's true. But friends, prayer is an act of worship. Everything in our holistic being is made for intimacy with God, and prayer is that intimacy that invites him into all of our being. And God can hold all of our honesty. Majority of Psalms is people screaming at God, where are you? Why aren't you coming through in the way I thought you would? When will you finally win? Why do the wicked prevail? And there's other psalms. God, I'm so sorry. They deal with our shame. I'm so sorry, God. I try to solve intimacy without you. And it brought more problems into my life. And it's brought more pain into my life. In their book, When Prayer Becomes Real, John Coe and Kyle Stobel make this observation. That prayer is not a place to be good, but a place to be honest. So yeah, there's a lot of things bubbling up inside of you as you're talking about this conversation, and there's directions and things you want to talk about. I'm certain of it. It's a difficult passage. But can I first and foremost invite you to pray and reconnect with God, who desires that intimacy with you first and foremost? Not to realign into another political conversation or to an agenda or to wherever your mind wants to go. Paul's warning here for us in 1 Corinthians is, as a template, do not do this. Do not connect sex in this way into worship to some idol that you feel will meet the need of your intimacy. Don't do that. Of course you're made for intimacy. Of course you're made for relationships. But you need to align that with God first and foremost. So can I invite you to pray through this week? Can I invite you to bring those things that are bubbling in your heart, or the pains or hurts or shames or frustrations or anger that you have with God or towards God? Can I invite you to pray into that conversation? Because God invites us into that intimacy. He invites us into that. Henry Nouwen put it this way. The real work of prayer is to become silent and to listen to the voice that says good things about me. To gently push aside and silence the many voices that question my goodness, and to trust that I will hear the voice of blessing, and that demands real effort. This is important. Prayer is important because in our honest conversations with God, we learn how God views us. And in his story, we learn he views us as very good. Opposite of the messages of shame that you may have held, or frustrations you hold in your heart and soul about sex and desires, or understanding, or other people's sex and desires, can I just invite you in your intimate relationship with God to bring those things to God first and foremost? The Hebrew word for God's love is hesed, and it's this covenantal love. It's this love that makes promises and commitments to us even when we break our commitments. the character of God we learn in the Hebrew Bible, whose anger we read blazed against them, pulling to the idols and mixing their sex with idols, was that God, we are breaking the covenant promises with God, and he said, but I won't break that with you. Our desire for intimacy is looking for God, for a relationship with him. And out of that relationship, our relationships to others outflow. God is continually reminding us that we are made in his image. And all our desires are actually for him. And the intimacy and the act of sex is good. And God ordained covenantal practice of trust and safety that happens in a covenantal, in a promised relationship of trust and safety. And so Apostle Paul is reminding us and helping us to realign this to this true love. And as we continue to look at God's story, and as we continue to unpack it all and try to make sense of our intimacy, as we bring the things that are good in our life and frustrations we have to God, as we look at all of it, let's look at God's story and how he responds in his covenantal love for us. How does he respond in our intimate relationship towards us? What does he do? Well, God's hesed love, or in the Greek, the agape love, which is like the overarching character of love, God's response in his hesed love, this covenantal promise love, agape love, this overarching love, I know I'm using like Hebrew and Greek here together. It's kind of fun. But in those two things, his response is he becomes one of us. God's response isn't to pull away and become more distant. God's response isn't to say, well, you blew it. God's response is, I've created you for intimacy and relationship, and I'm going to become one of you. And he does. And Jesus becomes a human. And he experiences the desires, the impatience, the temptations that we experience. He experienced the feelings of isolation, loneliness. This was all reality for him. And he carries the full weight of it. He took, and then he takes this full weight of all this brokenness, all our impatience, all our over desires, and all our messing about, and he takes it all to the cross. He does it out of this intimate love for us to defeat the power of death. An act of intimacy for us was deeply lived by Jesus. Friends, what is more loving and intimate than that? Than God not pulling away, but actually stepping into our mess and loving us and taking what we cannot take to the cross to put it to death. God did and does what we can't. He extends his mercy and grace to the world hell-bent on destruction, evil, and corruption and abuse, to give dignity, hope, love, and ultimately life to all of us. When we step into the way of Jesus, this way of life, we actually begin to join him in the renewal of an impatient and frustrated world. When we step in the way of Jesus, we begin to live in dignity, hope, love, and life where there is none. We begin to offer that because Jesus has shown us how to do that.